Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of December. This hour of the program, some interesting questions. What cities in the world have the highest growth rates when we look at employment, when we look at income? And why are they in that category instead of at the bottom of the list? Well, this hour of the program, Alan Berube will be joining us, Senior Fellow and Research Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. They've just done this very interesting study, Global Metro Monitor, The Path to Economic Recovery, a preliminary overview of 150 global metropolitan economies in the wake of the Great Recession. We're going to be welcoming phone calls. Can we learn from those cities in the world? And we may give you a little preview here. Many of them are, most of them actually, are not in the United States. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Alan, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. So, this was a huge study, wasn't it, to look at all of these cities in the world?
Yeah, I don't recommend others try it. But yeah, it had worldwide ambitions to look at the nature of urban and metropolitan economic growth really over the past 15 years before, during, and after the Great Recession.
Yeah. I guess one of the striking things about this is that the whole world has shifted. So the cities that are doing very well by large measure are not in this country anymore.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, at least when you look at how fast cities are growing economically, the United States and Europe don't really head the pack. A few places in the United States and Europe were among the top growing economies worldwide before the recession, but certainly the recession affected our part of the globe, the European part of the globe, much more severely than it did rising markets in Latin America and in Asia.
Mm-hmm. And how do you determine how city, what are the factors that determine whether or not a city is growing, is doing well?
Yeah, well, for context, it might help to describe sort of what these cities are and where they are. We looked at 150 places around the globe, really the 150 largest metropolitan economies, and those are the combinations of cities and suburbs that really form markets, regional markets. So it's not just the city of Milwaukee, but all the sort of surrounding counties that make up the Milwaukee labor market. And the same goes worldwide. Actually, these 150 places together account for about half of the world economy. I mean, you take 50 U.S. places, 50 places in Europe, and then 50 places in Asia, Australia, Latin America, and Africa. So in many ways, these are really the places that are driving global growth. And when we looked at which places were growing in terms of the number of jobs that they had, as well as in terms of the economic output of these places, it's really the cities and metropolitan economies in countries like China, India, Brazil, other places in Latin America that before, during, and after the Great Recession have really been at the top of the growth table.
And in the United States, tell me about cities that may have been doing well that have been used to be at the top of the list, and now they're just going down, 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 down.
Yeah, and it probably won't be a surprise to folks who study the American scene, but you know, many of our fastest growing economies in the period from, say, 1993 to 2007 were cities in the Sun Belt, like Las Vegas, Phoenix, Riverside, California, Orlando, Florida. And I think as a lot of your listeners probably recognize, these are places that succeeded by building a lot of housing, attracting a lot of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
But when the housing bubble popped, they were hurt much more severely than a lot of other places in the United States and a lot of other places worldwide. So you had a city like Las Vegas that was the 14th fastest growing metropolitan economy worldwide before the recession, actually dropped to about 140 146 after the recession, because it was, you know, that growth model was interrupted so much more severely than
others. Isn't that something? Holy cow, what a drop.
Yeah, you know, for some of these cities, like Las Vegas, and some counterparts in Europe, too, if you look at cities in Eastern Europe, like Riga, Latvia, or Madrid, Spain, or Dublin, Ireland, been in the news a lot lately. All of these places were fast-growing before the recession, but when that asset bubble popped, they all tumbled to the bottom of the list.
It was amazing. To me, I haven't done a lot of foreign travel lately, but was it 2 years ago? Three years ago, our family went to and really traveled the whole breadth and length of Ireland, north and south. And I was astounded. This wasn't the Ireland I knew. And it was amazing how many new houses everywhere, from little tiny communities, rural communities. Everybody had a new house. And I thought, oh, my gosh.
Ireland and, you know, a lot of sections of the United States thought that they had, you know, subverted the rules of economic growth, that you could just, you could build an economy around assets and asset prices, and that things like home prices would always and forever continue to rise. That didn't turn out to be the case. It never has been the case. And when it popped, so much of the economy, not just you know, folks' savings and, you know, what they invested in their homes, but all the industry that goes around that, construction, landscaping, you know, retailers that provide things for your home, all of that contracted severely and so sort of brought the whole economy crashing down with it.
Are we, Alan, you talk about Metro performance ranking before, during, and after the Great Recession. Are we at the after the Great Recession stage right now?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends where you look. So I'd answer that a couple of ways. First is that the way economists judge when a recession ends is deviate somewhat from how any normal person would judge when a recession ends. I think people judge when a recession ends by are jobs growing again? Is the unemployment rate coming down? At least in the United States, that's not yet really the case. We have jobs have been growing, but at a really kind of a snail's pace for several months now, and the unemployment rate is sort of stuck between 9.5% and 10%. The economy is expanding again. That is the amount of goods and services that the United States and most of its metropolitan economies produce is on the rise. That's what economists look at when they judge whether or not we're still in recession. And that, by that measure, the recession ended over a year ago. Yet when you look at a lot of metropolitan economies around the globe, especially in the United States and in Europe, several continue to lose jobs over the past year. And a handful, like Las Vegas, like Barcelona and Dublin, also continue to contract in that more conventional sense. That is, the size of those economies was shrinking, not just the number of jobs.
It's very interesting, and you may want to go through the list with us to look at the cities, the metro areas that are performing at the top after the Great Recession. I mean, we're looking the top 10. There's not one American city. It's Istanbul and lots of cities in metro areas in China, in and Lima and Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah, all of the best performing, that is the fastest growing economies from 2009 to 2010, were located outside the United States and Europe.
Goodness.
As you mentioned, Istanbul is at the top of the list, Lima, Peru up there, Singapore, the fourth fastest growing economy, several places in China, some of which I really didn't understand before doing this study, like Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Tianjin, and then many cities in India as well, Mumbai, Bangalore, Kolkata, Chennai. Now, none of this is to suggest that these places are more productive or wealthier than Milwaukee or really any other metropolitan economy. But what they're doing is they are expanding faster. More and more of global capital and growth is headed in their direction. And if you extend the trend line out, say 30, 40, 50 years, you see these places catching up to their counterparts in the U.S. and Europe.
So what's happening in a place like, because I'm quite frankly was surprised at Istanbul. You don't think about Istanbul, most of us, every day. It's just not on the map. What are they doing that the other metro areas are not doing?
Well, Istanbul seemed to have a couple of things going for it during and after the recession. And in fact, the recession hit Istanbul, again, not as hard as a lot of U.S. cities, but jobs shrank there, output shrank during the recession. But it's bounced back very quickly, very strongly, for a couple of reasons. One is that there was really no substantial asset price bubble in Turkey, in Istanbul. Not too much of their economy was tied up in housing and asset prices. Mm. Nor were their banks, like their American and European, unlike their American and European counterparts, tied up in sophisticated, exotic financial instruments, doing a lot of trading on these things, which was really the sort of Rube Goldbergian device that multiplied the impact of the house price bubble in the United States and nearly brought the world financial sector crashing down. That was not something that Istanbul and Turkey's banks were into. So when things got messy in the banking sector in the United States and Europe, a lot of global capital looking for a safe place to park to ride it out went to countries like Turkey, went to countries in Latin America that had, safer, sound banking system. So I think it's benefited from that investment. And then the other thing is that Istanbul is a strong exporting nation in things like textiles, low to medium value manufactured goods, which remain in great demand in the world marketplace, especially in developing nations like China and India. So I think its connection to other strong performing parts of the globe has held it in good stead over the past
year. Oh, that's so interesting. And what about Milwaukee? As long as I'm sitting here in Milwaukee, what about Milwaukee?
Yeah, Milwaukee. Milwaukee actually, I think, resembles some other counterparts in the industrial belt of the United States. So when we looked before the recession, we looked at the sort of 15 years from 1993 to 2007, Milwaukee was one of the slowest growing metropolitan economies worldwide. It ranked 141st out of 150. Employment was growing at a very slow rate. The economy was expanding, but not even at the U.S. national average nor at the global average. The recession, not very kind to Milwaukee either, given the big contraction in the manufacturing sector that occurred from 2007 to 2009. However, Milwaukee is coming out of the recession a bit stronger than before. It's ranked 83rd out of the 150 metro areas, so around the average performance, certainly better than before. While jobs still really haven't recovered in the Milwaukee metro, output is bouncing back, and I think that's attributable to what we're seeing in a bunch of other cities in that region of the country, Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, that have a manufacturing focus and are benefiting from a strong bounce back in the manufacturing sector, restocking of inventories, a somewhat weaker dollar on the world market, all of which tend to redound to the benefit of manufacturers. Mm-hmm.
We're welcoming phone calls for our guest. Ellen Berube is with us, Senior Fellow and Research Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program for the Brookings Institution. And we're looking at a massive study they did, and it's just really interesting that examined 150 large metro areas throughout the world to find out which economies are performing better in terms of growth, in terms of really employment, in terms of income. And it's amazing who's growing and who's not. We are not, they are. And they means Asia and India and places in South America as well. So why? A lot of them didn't get involved in the whole housing bubble situation. But it was fascinating to hear about Istanbul, wasn't it? Who would have thought we'd be spending some of today thinking seriously about Istanbul? It's worth thinking about. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you would like to send us an email, that would be dandy. And that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Lines are open for you at this very moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Tom in Galesville. Hello, Tom. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I really appreciate your author. He is right on asset valuation, and I call it the pseudo-economy for the last 30 years. And I don't care. It actually started in the Carter administration, but we went through Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2, and into Obama. It was based on the pseudo-economy of asset valuations while manufacturing was leaving this country. Everyone was fine with it as long as they saw that, you know, asset valuations were going up. And that is no way to create wealth. Wealth and thus job creation is created through manufacturing, farming, forestry, mining, fishing, you know, and a few other things. All the other things just move money piles around.
Alan.
Yeah, I appreciate Tom's point. I think he's right on about the value of manufacturing and the fact that we devalue that. We and, you know, other countries, developed countries around the world, seem to devalue that in the run-up to the Great Recession. I think that that's not just a function of what individual households or firms think and value. It's a reflection of public policy in the United States, too, and the fact that we've got massive subsidies, for instance, in the tax code for things like the deductibility of mortgage interest, or we have big subsidies for extractive industries and sort of older and dirtier forms of energy. And we're not really thinking about, well, how can we plow that money into things that are actually going to make us a more productive and economically sustainable nation? Things like high-value manufacturing, things like the green economy. I think we've lost sight of the inextricable link between what we make in the United States and innovation. And I think we thought, well, we can offshore all the stuff that we make, and we can just be a high-value services and sort of leading-edge innovation nation. But you can't do both at the same time, because your ability to invent new products and processes and business models depends on your ability to deploy and test those things before they move to some other country.
Who's got the market on innovation?
Boy, you know, I think we're still a leading country on innovation. I think we still have the best entrepreneurial spirit of any nation. We have flexible venture capital that can move towards new ideas, new products, new models. But other folks are catching up very, very quickly. And I think, you know, a country like China is plowing a lot of money now into its universities, into advanced labs, into being the real producers for the green economy and making the things that are going to help us transition to a lower carbon form of life. So I think we've perhaps sort of rested on our laurels of American exceptionalism for too long. And I think the growth rates that you're seeing in a lot of these global cities outside the United States and Europe are indicative of a really intentional policy climate for moving up the value chain and growing the middle class and growing the sorts of jobs that are going to sustain the middle class.
And can we, or is this way off base, Alan, can we make a link between the manufacturing jobs that have left the United States, and many, many of them have, to either go to South America, Central America, or to China for the most part? Have those resulted in those other economies and those other metro areas expanding?
I certainly think so. I mean, many of these Chinese cities, for instance, that we're looking at in the global metro model, Shenzhen, Guangzhou. I mean, Shenzhen 25 years ago was a fishing village of about 20 or 30,000 people. Today, it's a metropolis of 10 million people. Lots of low, medium, and some high-value manufacturing occurring there. It has the fourth largest seaport in the world. And the fact that they've been making things for a while now and attracting people there to fill those jobs and meeting demand in the global marketplace has enabled them to move up the value chain as well. So they used to make cell phones and other telecommunications devices for firms in other countries. Now they are headquarters to Huawei and ZTE. These are two of the world's leading global telecommunications firms. I don't think those firms would be there if they hadn't built that manufacturing capacity and the innovation capacity that comes along with that.
Yeah, interesting. Let's go to Jan from Madison. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I'm grateful for the conversation. In the last 4 years, I've done work, including extensive consumer research in places like Monterrey, Mexico, and Guangzhou, and Shanghai, and Mumbai, and Chennai. And what I've experienced there is a couple of things. One is just a great personal belief right now in individual strengths, which is very different than we have here. A huge number of people are not only working full-time, they're going to school full-time. And they feel a sense of excitement. And that alone can propel a lot of momentum. The other thing that I've experienced in the U.S., where I myself am an innovator, my work is more accepted in other parts of the world than here, where what I call the Harvardization of America has trapped us with best practices. It's not an accident that General Motors was not successful with Chevrolet designs until they went to Shanghai. In Detroit, they were captured by the one way they believed was the best practice for getting it done, which is follow the leader, tell me how to do it, and that's the one way to do it. The other places in the world are looking at our innovation and saying, if I do it that way, I fail. Why would I do it that way again?
That's great. Thanks for your comments, Jan. It's good to talk to somebody who's actually been in these other places in the world and talked with individuals and consumers one-on-one to sort of get their perspective on growth and opportunity. I think that what your comments are suggesting is it's not just the challenge coming from other parts of the world that I think we have to face up to if we want to continue to achieve high and rising standards of living for the United States, but it's also the opportunity that's out there for us and our firms that are more globally oriented and are thinking about, well, what do we make and what services do we provide in the United States that don't only feed our internal domestic market, but can actually reach the growing global middle class. And that middle class is coming from these cities like Guangzhou and Shenzhen and Chennai and all these cities that are at the top of the list over the next 25 to 30 years. That's where the bulk of the growth and the global middle class is going to come from. And I think if our country and our cities and our firms are going to succeed going forward, it's not going to be enough just to think about where they nest domestically. They have to think internationally, and they have to open themselves to the opportunities that are out there and the competition that comes along with that.
An issue with that is that the companies that are going global are looking at those global sites for profit. They're using those as cash cows, bringing the profit back to the U.S. where they're banking it, getting huge stock price increases, getting credit for that as if they're quote-unquote growing, and yet none of that is triggering anything that's happening in the U.S.
So
on the one hand, it sounds like, and for the last 15 years, global companies have said it's all about the rest of the world. Well, yeah, it's all about the rest of the world because that's where they can make cash.
Yeah, indeed. I think it goes back to Tom's comment from earlier that there's only, I think there's a limit to what you can outsource in terms of your capital investment in these foreign markets. And if you're going to rely on, as I think these firms need to, the ingenuity of Americans to push the leading envelope of innovation to develop these new products, processes, and business models, you cannot separate that physically and within a firm very long without eroding your innovative capacity. So I think these firms would be losing their edge if they thought they could do everything in these foreign markets. I still think we have the most talented workforce in the United States, the most innovative institutions in our universities. They're the envy of the world. So I think firms and cities and metropolitan areas need to think about deploying those in ways that not only are about the the very, very tippy-top high end of the economy, the PhD scientists and engineers, but how that all interacts with the what some folks call the innovation ecosystem, which is really nested in these metropolitan areas and is ultimately what's going to help these places to succeed here and abroad.
You know what I love about this study is that you're drawing attention to parts of the world that we don't think about. Our news is dominated, but when you hear international news, it's about, you know, what's happened in England, in Spain, in Greece, and the downfall of the economies. What a whole new way to look at all of this. This is what works. This is why they have survived. This is where they're being innovators. It just it sparks our minds to think about, well, what can we do?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think this study is trying to make a contribution in a couple of ways. One is, as you've noted, to focus on these other parts of the globe, not just from a national security perspective and a focus on what the central governments happen to be doing, but from an economic perspective and sort of ask, well, what seem to be the ingredients of economic success in a place
right.
like
yes.
Shenzhen or a place like Lima? And I think the other thing it's doing is stressing that, well, ultimately, you know, China is leading on growth because it's these particular distinct cities that are leading on growth. I mean, what Beijing does, what Shanghai does, is different from what Guangzhou or Shenzhen do. What Sao Paulo does is different from what Rio de Janeiro does. So at the end of the day, these national economies, as this study stresses, are really just the aggregate of these metropolitan economies, all of which play very distinct and important roles at the national and at the global level economically.
We have a lot of emails coming in as well. This is from Adam in La Crosse. I was wondering which U.S. cities are doing the best economically after the recession.
That's a great question. And I think it goes back to what we were hinting at earlier, noting that Milwaukee sort of bumped up the list a bit in the wake of the recession. So you have some places that performing well relative to other U.S. places like Austin, Texas, Washington, D.C., by virtue of the fact that that they are home to industries like government, universities that continued to grow or were at least stable during the recession. So they've bounced back a little bit more quickly from a shallower recession. But you also have cities like Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, Boston, Cincinnati, that have a somewhat older industrial base in many cases, but have experienced quite rapid output growth in the past year because of the strong bounce back of the manufacturing sector, you know, given how well the big three are doing now. The auto supply chain has rebounded quite strongly, and that's redounded to the benefit of a lot of cities that before the recession were performing quite poorly. Now, whether this is just a one-year blip or it's going to be a sustained trend over time, I think we have yet to see. And I think it depends on really what's the United States' stance on manufacturing. Are we going to do things that make it a larger and more viable part of our economy going forward?
So if you were looking at the strength of the Midwest, and manufacturing is one of the strengths, I can remember not that long ago talking with somebody who said that he really knew the economy of this region, that what we need is to move into something that perhaps we haven't done very much of, be that green technology, be it solar energy, where China's doing a lot of work, or clean coal, or whatever it is, that we need to find ourselves a vision because we've got manufacturing here. Is that the way for us to go so that we can get people back to work in this part of the country?
I think it's part of it. I don't think there is any one silver bullet for any one region or city for economic success. I think diversity of approach is important for long-run economic growth and insulating yourselves against the ravages of a recession that might affect one or more sectors disproportionately. We've been saying to U.S. metropolitan areas and to the national government that the new vision for the economy has to be a few things. It has to be export-oriented because we can't depend just on American consumers to drive this recovery. They're dealing with a debt overhang that's going to take a long time to work out. And as I was saying before, there's a growing global middle class out there and nations that need new products and technologies that the United States can play a role in providing. It has to be lower carbon, both because that's the imperative of the challenges of global climate change that are before us, but also because there's a rising demand for that stuff out there. And to the extent that we can be at the leading edge of developing technologies that help people create lower carbon economies, help provide the products to power the United States and other nations, will be well served. And it has to be fueled by innovation, not innovation in financial services and the other sorts of crazy products that got us into this mess, but real innovation, innovation in services, innovation in manufacturing that not only drive very high-value growth here, but also produce jobs that are accessible to the middle class, that recognize the linkages between innovation and deployment. And I think, for instance, the fact that the Midwest is home to the Big Ten universities, lots of federal labs, I think enhancing the linkages between those institutions and the marketplace and the commercialization of technologies, that has to be a part of the path forward for the Midwest. It has tremendous assets to build on there.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're on our way. Thanks for the advice. Julia in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. We happened to be last spring on a trip with the National Trust to Turkey and spent 2.5 weeks there. And our guide throughout was a lifelong resident of Istanbul, a very erudite man. And he was pointing out the fantastic, amazing growth of Istanbul physically and population-wise. And he was very concerned about the high unemployment rate in Turkey. I think he said 20% unemployed among youth. They have a high, their youth population is very high versus the elderly. And people are flooding to Istanbul for jobs, which he says do not exist, except in the very low end. So I'd be interested in your guest's take on whether the growth of a great city like Istanbul necessarily equates to terrific growth financially of the entire country. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Julia. Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Julia. And I think what you're pointing out and your guide in Istanbul was pointing out that the economic growth, while good over the long run perhaps for a city and a nation in terms of the average standard of living it can provide, brings with it other challenges, especially in the developing world and low- to middle-income countries like Turkey. There are enormous environmental sustainability challenges and congestion challenges that come with a sort of rapid growth and in migration from rural areas that these megacities are experiencing right now. Not everybody has access to clean water, to good infrastructure for getting themselves around. So there are big challenges that come with providing a good and healthy environment for urban dwellers to live in. And the other challenge is that the distribution of this expanding economy like Istanbul can be quite uneven as well. I mean, we're certainly familiar with income inequality in America, but it's these developing cities are no stranger to it either. And you can grow the size of the pie, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's share is going to grow, and there may be limited employment opportunity, as you're noting, for some groups like youth. There may be a lot of low-end jobs that aren't really enough for a family to live on very well, but a lot of high-end jobs that are occupied by people from a different strata in the society. So we're just looking at this study at one aspect of growth, and that's economic growth. But I think, as we come back to this subject in the future and we look more in depth at what's actually going on in a city like Istanbul or Lima, when you peel back the onion a little bit, not all is rosy, and I think a lot of the challenges that they're facing are going to persist unless there's a really intentional policy from their governments to widen the circle of opportunity that comes with economic growth and to deal with some of the severe environmental challenges that that growth can create.
Yeah, and we have a question, as it would be, about environmental issues. Gary from Boscobel. Hi, Gary.
Good morning. I would like to ask your guests about the growth of these cities and how that relates to the countries they're in and whether there's weak or non-existent environmental protection laws in those countries or in those areas where those where that growth has taken place. And I'd also like to make the comment as looking at as a form of a metaphor, and an ecologist looking at the planet Earth as a living, functioning organism, that it seems to me like what we're doing by evaluating the growth of these big cities is checking the size of the tumors on the living planet. And I'd like his comment on that.
Well, first let me try to tackle the question about the strength of environmental protections in these nations. And when you talk about a country like China, for instance, I think a lot of the growth that a city like Shenzhen experienced over the last 15 or 20 years came at the cost of environmental quality. And everybody remembers the 2008 games in Beijing and the fact they had to keep all the cars off the roads for a couple of weeks before the Olympics so that the air quality wasn't so bad. So I think that these countries like China, like some in Latin America, have made an explicit trade-off between the quality of the environment and economic growth. I think that as these countries continue to grow economically, though, and as their middle class expands, the environmental and economic research suggests that those groups are going to, as their standard of living increases, want to devote some of that increased standard of living to improving environmental quality. So I don't think that that's a trade-off that they can continue to make forever. And I think that the growth of those economies is eventually going to bring with it increased attention to the environmental degradation that they've experienced. And when you look at certain places in China, I think they're going through that reckoning right now. As for whether cities are tumors on the planet, I think that with now a majority of the world's population living in cities for the first time, projections are that it's on its way to 70% by 2050. I think cities can actually be the solution to a lot of the planet's environmental challenges because they bring with them density that lowers our collective carbon footprint. They bring with them, as I was mentioning, increased incomes and standards of living, which translate into greater demand for environmental quality. New York is our lowest carbon footprint city in the United States,
really?
Much more so than more rural places in the United States, which are much more resource intensive. So I think we should look at the growth of cities domestically and internationally as a real opportunity to address the environmental problems that we have, both through economic growth, but through a different and more sustainable form of living.
Alan, when you say 70% by 2050, what is it now living in metro areas?
Just by the United Nations reckonings, just crossed the 50% threshold in 2007, 2008.
That's a lot, though, isn't it? That's
a lot of people. Back in 1950, we were at about 30% of world population living in cities and metropolitan areas. In this country, it's been a majority for quite a long time, for over 100 years now. But especially in developing parts of the globe, urbanization and the rise of cities is a relatively new phenomenon, really over the past three or four decades.
Alan Berube is our guest this hour of the program. He's senior fellow and research director at the Metropolitan Policy Program of the Brookings Institution. They have just released a fascinating study, Global Metro Monitor, The Path to Economic Recovery. It's an overview of 150 global metropolitan economies in the wake of the Great Recession. Those metro areas doing well are, for the most part, not in the United States. Many of them are in China. Istanbul ranks number one, and several of the countries now are in South America as well. I know we have a question about Brazil. I know 60 Minutes did a piece on Brazil last night, so we'll get to that question. More of your phone calls. If you've been trying to get through, now would be a good time for you to call us because you can get through. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We also have several emails we will get to. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls now. Gary is next from Eagle River. Hi, Gary.
Good morning. I watched a interesting segment last night on 60 Minutes, and part of it was on the Brazilian economy. And the economy of Brazil 10, 12 years ago or so was absolutely on life support. I mean, it just barely was able to make it without help of the World Bank and so forth. And now it's growing so rapidly that last year it added 1.5 million jobs, new jobs. Well, we lost 8 million new jobs. And one of the topics that came up was had to do with the last time Brazil had been at war. What I found out is that the last time they were at war was in 1870. That's 140 years ago. And they asked one of the big moguls down there about that, and he said, why would we want to go to war when we can go to our beautiful beaches? And it's a bit flippant, but I'm very concerned about our economy, that not as much just about the $1 trillion plus that we're spending on the war, but that we're losing our focus. We haven't been focused on our economy and competing with the rest of the world for at least 10 years now. And my question then to you is, how many of these rapidly growing areas of the world are in countries that are actively at war at this point of time?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
That's a great question. And I think while you could argue that some of these countries face greater domestic instability than we do. So some of the leading cities in India might, around religious tensions, or Riyadh and Saudi Arabia, certainly at the heart of a rather unstable region, Cairo and Alexandria in Egypt also on the precipice of it. Most of these cities are not in countries that are actively part of foreign conflict right now. I think most of them aren't in countries that feel like they could afford to do that sort of thing. And as I think the caller's Brazilian example suggests, a lot of these places are really focused on the economy first and foremost right now and how it can generate rising standards of living for its population. I agree that we have strayed in the United States over the past decade or more. I think the debate over the extension of the Bush tax cuts that happened last week in Washington is a perfect reflection of that. We weren't asking, well, what do we actually need to do to grow our economy, not just in the short term, but in the medium and long term? And what sorts of revenues do we need to raise to do that? Or where should we be placing our tax subsidies? It was none of that. It was, okay, well, let's kick that can down the road a few more years. You know, maybe we'll settle it in 2012. I wouldn't bet on it. But it was not nested in a real discussion about how we position ourselves, our workers, our firms, to succeed domestically, to compete internationally. So I think we have a lot to learn from countries like Brazil and others abroad that are much more focused on how they can do that.
And what are, when you answer that question, what do we need to grow our economy? The obvious answers to you would be?
Well, I think we need, as I was talking about closer to the beginning of the show, to think about redeploying the resources that we use to subsidize the old economy right now, a consumption-fueled economy, an economy too focused on housing, things like the mortgage interest deduction, things like subsidies for oil and resource extraction, and move them towards manufacturing, a low-carbon economy, innovation, and the role of high value added services. I think, thinking about the vision for the next economy is the first thing we need to do and agree on. And then we should be devising tax policy, budget policy, reforming entitlements with the notion of supporting those assets and investments in mind.
Let's go to another email. Recently in the Atlantic magazine, a report on the least corrupt countries and also those where students scored highest on measurements of knowledge of math, science, and critical thinking. The countries on the top included Denmark, New Zealand, Singapore, Sweden, Australia. How do these countries or the metropolitan areas score on your measure? Judy from Milwaukee.
Oh, another excellent question. I think when you look at the European countries in that, in those examples, like Denmark, like Finland, their cities did not perform particularly well in the short run because of the sovereign debt crisis. There was a big overhang in Europe through much of the early part of this year. Australia, on the other hand, many of its cities rank in the top half of the rankings and from 2009 to 2010, outperforming most of their U.S. and European counterparts. I think the role of growing human capital in those places is an important factor, as well as their export focus, their linkages based on proximity in large measure to growing parts of the globe in East Asia and South Asia, and the relationships between their manufacturers, their financial institutions in that part of the world, helping to explain the better performance of their cities.
Gary, thanks for your call. We go to Jane next on the road. Hi, Jane.
Hey, yeah, I noticed that early in the program you used agriculture, I think, was one of the economies that you said we might try to develop more. And I work in Wisconsin in agriculture, and one of the things that we've been growing closer and closer to is developing local markets for food distribution. And I'm talking local, like within 100 or 200 miles of where they're produced is where they're consumed. And I'm curious if that at all registers as an example of what you're talking about, or if no, that's a whole different economic strategy.
I think that's, for places that have a long-standing specialty in that, I think that can be an important part of a strategy. I didn't look at the particular role of agriculture in explaining metropolitan performance. But, you know, back to the questions about, the trade-offs and the linkages between economic growth and environmental sustainability, I think we need to build better cities in the United States in part to preserve the fact that we have a very important export in agriculture. So it's not just about, for economic growth purposes at least, preserving agriculture in Wisconsin to support Madison and Milwaukee, but preserving agriculture in Wisconsin because it's a very important thing that our nation does that can support this growing global middle class elsewhere in the world and generate high and rising standards of living for the people in this country.
Thank you, Jane, for your call. Bruce in Wausau. Hi.
Yes, good morning. And I have a couple of questions for your guest there. I'm almost 70 years old, and I became very alarmed in the late 60s and early 70s in regards to the tremendous number of jobs that were being outsourced overseas, primarily into the Asian basin. And I was talking with a lot of my friends, in the business sector about if this keeps up, by the year 2000, we'll basically be buying everything from foreign countries and making nothing. And I never thought I'd ever see this happen, but I was with a bunch of people. They were professional people about 2 weeks ago. And I asked them if they could find anything in the room that we were in that was made in the United States. And the only thing we didn't do is take the tile off the floor to see where it was made. But we couldn't find anything in that whole room that was made here in this country.
Except maybe yourselves, right?
That I was going to say, you took the words right out of my
mouth.
We almost fell over on the floor when we came to that conclusion.
Huh.
And I wonder how long we can keep this up.
I don't think we can keep it up, frankly. I mean, we shouldn't discredit the fact that the United States still makes a lot of things that it itself consumes, that other nations consume in terms of the auto sector, aerospace, very high value technologies, pharmaceuticals. So we still have some real strengths here. We don't have to rebuild from nothing. But I think we have, as the caller suggests, reached the limit of the extent to which we can divorce physically and within the operations of firms production from innovation. And I think that if we're going to be successful at the high end, the medium end, and the low end of this economy moving forward and regrow our middle class, that manufacturing has to be a part of this equation, and we have to have a strategy at the city level, at the state level, at the national level for making that happen.
Thank you very much. Unless you had a follow-up, Bruce.
Yes.
Okay.
The other thing is the I don't know if you've ever traveled to Europe, but I spent quite a bit of time in Germany and France and Switzerland, and I was absolutely shocked at the level of education in the pursuit of scientific and engineering skills. And I came back here, and it was so blatant and so obvious to me that I actually became almost fearful.
Alan, we have about 20 seconds.
Yeah, actually, you know, I think the United States now ranks 45th in the world in the share of its college graduates who are in science and engineering fields. So I agree, any part of a broader strategy on production in America needs to have a big human capital component. It's about people at the very high end, but also about what skills do people need to be skilled manufacturers.
How do we get the report online?
You can go to our website, which is www.brookings.edu, and just search for Global Metro Monitor.
All right. Thank you. What a great study and an interesting hour. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Alan Berube, Senior Fellow and Research Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. The report is highly interesting and well worth reading. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 here on the Ideas Network.